Everything we do is music.
Acoustic space. Boundless, directionless, horizonless.
36.
20.
20.
20.
Welcome to 3620, podcasting from the basement of 3620 Walnut Street by the doctoral students of the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. I'm Deb Loy. Today on the podcast, Karina Laughlin and Kevin Godkin bring us field notes from an ethnography they conducted last summer. From June until August 2013, Karina and Kevin followed a spiritual community that organizes ultra-long-distance running events. This piece today is called Sonic Field Notes from the World's Longest Race. Hope you enjoy.
Day 1. Miles covered. 0.
Yes.
Okay, we're good.
We're good. It's going to be really fun. I'm excited.
This is so exciting. Wow, look at this.
It's the middle of June, 2013. Karina and I are in a friend's car driving from Brooklyn to Jamaica, Queens, in New York City. It's about 5:30 in the morning.
164 Place.
Okay.
We arrive next to a small playground just off of the Grand Central Parkway.
This is it. This is the block.
As Karina parallel parks, I glance around. There are some basketball and handball courts next to the playground and a large turf field that stretches across to a high school at the other side. I look up the street and I see some people milling around near an RV.
I mean, whatever you want.
Let's just drive around the block.
Oh, this might be a one-way.
This is totally a one-way.
Well, we're just having fun on the one-way.
We're at the start of a race, but not just any weekend morning road race. We're at an ultra marathon. In fact, this is the world's longest ultra marathon. If you're picturing a group of elite runners surrounded by teams of coaches and assistants, taping up their legs, squeezing the last drops from their energy gel packets, well, you probably have the wrong idea. The stock images we have in our minds of American ultra-distance racing usually include warrior-like bodies grimacing as they plod along before a triumphant, emotional finish. But this race, here at 6 a.m. in Queens, is not like that.
Here's a Sharpie.
Oh, the Sharpie's better.
In reality, there's very little fanfare. People are arriving slowly, leisurely. Someone's testing out a speaker.
Good morning, Megan.
What?
Can you hear me?
Around the RV are two other race cars where the runners rest and keep their modestly sized bags of gear. There are three porta-johns and a small medical tent. This, we will find out, is called base camp. You can spot the athletes in their running gear. Everyone is dressed casually, many in white. Some people are setting up the liquids table, and some others with cameras are scoping out the best place for photos. But there is certainly no gun that marks the start of this race.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, go!
This is the 3100-mile self-transcendence race. It is the longest certified foot race in the world. The race is organized by the followers of the late Bengali spiritual guru, Sri Chinmoy. After immigrating to the U.S. in the 1970s, Chinmoy settled here in Queens, where many of his roughly 7,000 followers joined him. A large part of Chinmoy's teaching is about physical activity. He believed things like long-distance running and tennis and weightlifting could help you achieve what he called self-transcendence.
The second interesting thing about this race is that it all happens on the sidewalk of this one block. The block is just over half of a mile, and the runners circle it about 110 times per day. They need to finish the 3,100 miles in 52 days, a limit Chinmoy set himself. So that means they must average about 60 miles each day, which they run from 6 a.m. until midnight. Over the course of the 52 days, each runner needs to complete this loop more than 5,000 times. The followers of Sri Chinmoy call themselves his disciples, and they tell us that they're more like a spiritual organization that runs, rather than a running organization that is spiritual. When you spend a lot of time at the race, you realize how serious the spiritual dimension really is. Many of the women wear saris, a fashion that was encouraged by the guru because of its modesty. They seem to glide around base camp, often singing songs written by their guru. Every morning when the runners get to the starting line at 6 a.m., they bow their heads for a moment of silence. And then they're off.
Day 3, lead runner at 217 miles.
Today is the first day we've stayed at the race through the night. I'm sitting at a counting table, calling out the laps to those runners who want to hear them.
91, sir, I got there.
It's a warm summer night, and the shuffle of the runners' feet as they come by is a peaceful, lulling sound. It's pretty much the only sound surrounding me now that the kids from the high school have gone home and the nearby park is empty. A disciple I haven't met before stops by to keep me company. Her name is Roshna.
Just a side note here, some of the names we're using are pseudonyms.
Roshna has just come from a play in Brooklyn about human trafficking. It's one that I've read about in the New York Times, and I'm excited to talk with her about it. She's wearing white pants and a white shirt, but manages to keep her clothes pristine as she gingerly eats leftover chocolate cake with her hands. It turns out that we have a lot in common. She asks about grad school and tells me that she has a master's in women's studies and that both of her parents are academics. As we sit and talk about the play and about our lives, the runners keep running by. She's so inspired by how they're continuing Sri Chinmoy's vision, and she tells me about the experience of picking Chinmoy as her guru. She says that she initially had wanted a female guru, but as soon as she met Sri Chinmoy, she knew that he was the one for her. She tells me that Chinmoy was a feminist. He encouraged men and women equally. I ask her about all the Bengali names that the disciples have. Someone told me that they were given to them by the guru himself when he was alive, and she says that's true. They were given to people individually in a special ceremony. I ask her how new disciples will get their spiritual names now that Sri Chinmoy has died, and I mention that someone said they might do it by committee. Roshna says that's too mind-focused. Their guru taught that minds divide people. Minds are critical. It is only by meditating on the heart chakra, not the beating heart, that we can understand our oneness with all people. She believes that new disciples will find their names through meditation. Of her own name, she tells me that she legally changed it. Mostly, she says, because she found it beautiful. As we are sitting and talking, a couple of police stop by. They're surprised by the whole idea of the race, but good-natured. What does the winner get? One asks. And we tell him that they don't get anything, at least not any money. The cops marvel a minute at the leaderboard and then move on. This night we stay until midnight, and I'm surprised to see several of the runners riding off on bikes at the end of their long day of running.
Day 25, lead runner at 1,853 miles.
Arriving at the race each day to see the runners in the same rotation was inspiring. It was inspiring the way watching the World Cup makes you want to get out and play soccer, or seeing the U.S. Open makes you want to get to a tennis court. We'd find ourselves watching the runners come and go, and we were often hit with a wave of excitement that made us want to get up and run. The disciples described this as an otherworldly energy. It's powerful, isn't it? They'd ask. Then they'd smile and head off for a long run of their own. We began to think of running during the race as part of our research. We should try, right? We'd ask each other in the car. But if we tried, we wouldn't want to assume we'd gain some exclusive or objective insight into what this community experiences. We weren't really sure exactly what kind of evidence we could gather from running, but we knew we wanted to try. Karina and I ran at the race here and there from the first week. We liked entering the community's 2-mile race that they hold every Saturday morning at 8 a.m. on a block right next to the 3,100-mile course. A few years earlier, I had run a marathon, and I was hankering for another big distance. So we started planning for me to spend a full day running alongside the athletes. We picked a Sunday in mid-July. I decided I wanted to run 52 miles. That's 2 marathons in a row, but also 1 mile for each day of the race.
All right, so it's Sunday, July 21st. Hey. And I'm going to start running in a few minutes. Here we go.
Because the distance was so far beyond what I could imagine or try to understand, an odd calm set in as I went around and around the block. Each lap seemed so insignificant because I had so many more ahead of me.
Okay, now I'm on lap 4. I walked the first lap, and I started running on the second, and now I think I'm in a... Now I'm really starting to run.
Karina walked a lap with me not too long after I had just finished 27 miles, more than I had ever run before. Something odd had just washed over me.
So are we rolling yet?
What did you just experience?
I don't know. Like, I really felt like this overwhelming joy.
Yeah.
Like total joy on this lap. And I just like was like starting to like cry a little bit and just be like, wow.
That's amazing.
I don't know how to explain it, but I know that I had something like that when I was running my marathon, the Suffern Sentence Marathon. This the whole time I was just like so excited, you know?
Wow.
It's this, I don't know how to explain it. Like, it's just my lizard brain now, you know? Just like I'm feeling emotion, but not like articulating or like really, I'm just kind of like feeling it.
Although and you are articulating quite well.
Yeah, although I feel like I can't, I'm not capturing it at all. Like, overwhelming joy doesn't really get at it. It's like, I just felt like, whoa, yeah, I don't know what it is. And, like, I think it might go hand in hand with what we were talking about, like, how you don't...
Day 30, lead runner at 2,052 miles.
Okay, it's Friday, then we have two severe weather alerts from the Weather Channel iPhone app. One is an excessive heat warning in effect from 8 a.m. Until 8 p.m. for southern Queens. The other alert is an air quality alert for southern...
Day 35, lead runner at 2,300 miles.
Today, Sarah looks miserable and is incredibly discouraged. I overhear her telling a massage therapist, "I'm bored and hurting." She's thinking of not finishing. She stops after every lap out of habit. Later, two helpers who have been assisting other runners encourage her. They say, if you can get through this, you can get through anything in life.
Day 38, lead runner at 2,489 miles.
One of the disciples says to me, "You're really becoming one of the boys."
Day 42, lead runner at 2,749 miles.
Today, there are heat and air quality warnings. One of the runners, Sarvagata, looks dazed. It's day 4 of an epic heat wave. Yuri has to walk today because his resting heart rate last night was too high. The runners clutch onions in their hands as they run. We're told it's an Ayurvedic strategy to deal with the heat. Vasu carries a white onion. Ashprihanal clutches a red one. Not everyone takes the onion craze so seriously. Some disciples think it's mostly psychosomatic. A British disciple says, "What's up with the magic onions?" We volunteer to drive a disciple to the race's unofficial Ayurvedic doctor in Jackson Heights because he wants to get more advice on how to keep the runners cool in this intense, oppressive heat.
This particular disciple has been at the race every day, and we know him pretty well by this point. So we chat with him in the car on the drive out to Jackson Heights.
So we're chatting, and he asks if I've been to the Jefferson Memorial. I have. He's memorized the quote at the base of the memorial, and he recites it for us.
And then I remember the Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial that faces it, how King has his arms crossed looking across the water at Jefferson. And we start to discuss this in terms of Jefferson as a slave owner. This disciple stops the conversation and he says, "We're totally wrong." He says that Jefferson wasn't a slave owner. He was about freedom for all men.
I don't know why I felt like I had to assert myself here, but I said that actually Jefferson absolutely was a slave owner. And the disciple asks, "Are you sure?" And I say, "I'm positive."
In this moment, like in this exact moment, something begins to make sense.
The fact that we've already had similar conversations about Jefferson with other disciples.
The fact that disciples sell only books by Sri Chinmoy at their restaurant, except for one lone book about Thomas Jefferson.
And I think in this moment, I said something like, "I've noticed that Sri Chinmoy admired Thomas Jefferson." And he told us, well, that's because he was Thomas Jefferson in a previous incarnation. Okay, I think we have to stop here and mention a few things.
Along the way, we learned some things that didn't quite sit right with us.
There's a lot of tension in the community about the internet. Disciples are not really supposed to use it, but a lot of them do. And we started to notice that we were asked a lot of questions about whether or not we were looking things up on the internet and what we might be finding there.
We came to discover that there are ex-disciple forums online that detail various abuses within the community, including allegations that Chinmoy sexually abused some of his female followers.
We also discovered a book by Jayanti Tam, who was born into the Sri Chinmoy Center and who was granted the status of Chinmoy's chosen one. Chinmoy asked all of his followers to practice celibacy, and when Tam became interested in dating, she was brutally excommunicated. Her brother, who is still a disciple, never spoke to her again.
Day 52. 8 runners have finished 3,100 miles.
It's the evening of the last day of the race. Here's what I write in my notebook. Sun setting over the race. Nidruvi has stopped. Chopin has stopped. Sarah is saying her goodbyes. The chairs are empty. I am so sad.
Day 53.
We've been invited to the final ceremony for the 3,100-mile race, which is exciting because it's being held at Aspiration Ground, a sacred site for the disciples, partly because it's where, we're told, Sri Chinmoy is buried. One of the disciples offers to help me pick out a sari to wear at the ceremony. I've become friends with this particular disciple. We'll call her Nima. She's warm and maternal and kind. She's always smiling and laughing. She takes me to the disciple-owned clothing shop, Divine Robes Supreme, where I pick out a green sari. Nima ties the sari for me. It's a complicated process to pleat it in the Bengali style, and it requires quite a lot of safety pins, and we're giggling through the whole thing. When we're done, she spins me around to look in the mirror. "You look beautiful," she says. But I can't help feeling my stomach knot a bit as I think to myself, you look just like a disciple.
The discipline of anthropology has always been about making the strange familiar and the familiar strange. The ethnographer is the instrument through which this process occurs, but perhaps like any instrument, he is never completely objective. All of the thoughts and feelings that color our daily existence are heightened and changed in the field. We begin to see the world through the eyes of another, and a sometimes startling and sometimes beautiful vision takes shape in this process. Lisa Malky writes that ethnography is a process that, quote, demands a critical awareness of the invisible social factor that multiple different temporalities might be at play simultaneously. The process is inextricably embedded in relationally structured social lives, quotidian routines, events that become events with a capital E, the panic time of deadlines, the elongated time of boredom, the cyclical time of the return of the expected, the spiral time of returns to the recognized or the remembered, and so on. It engages the sense and the social and physical being of the ethnographer. It involves affect and makes demands on one's intuition. All of this is its analytical power and its messy challenge, end quote. And so we can't help but change and be changed by our experiences as ethnographers in the field. They are never really experiences in the field at all. In the end, the field is not someplace to be arrived at out there. The field feels much closer.
Day 100 or something.
It's a cold October day in Philadelphia. I've been transcribing for hours in my little cubicle in the basement of the Annenberg School. Transcribing is mostly dull work, but listening to this particular interview with Sarvagata, one of the runners from the Ukraine, has me rapt.
Well, it's pretty hard to describe to the fullest, but like, I would say it's a flow. And you're part of the flow. And it's sometimes it's mild and tender, sometimes it's powerful and like a wave. sometimes like a river, and it's all light, really shiny. I mean, like you look directly to the sun, but it doesn't hurt. And exciting. And you dissolve, and you it's a oneness with all creation, and also works. It's all just works. But I want it again.
Yeah, I want it again. As I'm listening to him, I begin to feel what it was like to be at the race.
Like
I begin to remember the feeling of the bubble. That special energy that all the disciples professed they could feel there, and that, to be honest, I felt at times too. And that reminder immediately brings tears to my eyes.
The views expressed on this podcast are those of its producers and do not represent the Annenberg School for Communication, its faculty, staff, or student body. The 3620 podcast is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-Alike International 3.0 license. That means you can remix, repost, or recycle any of the content as long as you aren't making money, you don't change the credits, and you share it under the same license.